Peak Wealth Management proudly presents Finding True Wealth with Nick Hopwood, where we believe by providing education and guidance, we help our clients make sound financial decisions, which ultimately puts them on a path towards their definition of true wealth. Now, here is your certified financial planner professional and founder of Peak Wealth Management, Nick Hopwood.
Welcome. Welcome, everyone, to episode 39 of Finding True Wealth. Today, we are joined by estate planning attorney Mark Wander from the Mark Wander Law Firm. Mark is a estate planner who focuses 100% of his time on estate planning. And if you want to learn more about Mark, you can go to mwanderlaw.com. And if that's too hard to remember, you can use zeroprobate.com, all spelled out. Mark's been practicing law for over 25 years, and he's had his own practice for the past 6 years in Bloomfield Hills, Michigan. Mark and his lovely wife, Amy, have three kids. And in today's discussion, I'm pretty much grilling Mark on what he calls the retirement trust concept. It applies to your IRA after you've passed away. We also talk about other things such as power of attorney, ladybird deeds, revocable trusts, estate taxes, and much more. So keep in mind as you're listening today, if you have any questions that come up with your own estate plan, I've asked Mark if he would speak with Peak clients on a complimentary basis for a first meeting. So keep that in mind. Without further ado, let's roll the tape. Hey, Mark, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
We got our technology all squared away here. Mark is on Skype remote, and we're recording the call. Hopefully the quality turns out pretty good. Usually we're in studio, but it worked out better for us today to be remote. And Mark is a rare case here, in addition because he's a Spartan fan. He's a Spartan grad, and normally we only allow Wolverine grads on, but we made the exception today. So welcome, Mark.
Well, thank you. If it helps any of my Michigan fans out there, that my nephew is on the football team, so maybe that equals things up.
Yeah, and you were just telling me a minute ago that you got a chance to go to practice recently. How was that?
It was really neat. It was in the Glick Fieldhouse, I think they call it, which is they have a 100-yard full-size football field inside, and I was able to watch the Michigan team practice, and they break it down into all the different positions, and it was just a really neat thing for me to see because I did not play football, and I'm not sure I've ever watched a full practice, let alone at a big-time program like Michigan.
Yeah, I had a chance to go to a practice back in the day, like 2010 or so, with Rich Rod, and that was back when there's some debate between who's going to be the quarterback. Should it be Tate Forcier or should it be Denard Robinson? And that was kind of fun watching that practice. Okay, so on to more important topics. Mark is an estate planning attorney. We want to tap his mind for what he's seen as the new trends and the newest trends in the industry, and also things that we need to be aware of and the common mistakes that we see with estate planning. So when I first met Mark, he was talking to me about his the way he structures retirement trusts. And Mark was pretty much the first person who ever brought this idea to my attention. And so why don't you explain to us what a retirement trust is, Mark?
Sure. Before I get into the trust, let me just give you a quick background on the way that retirement assets are distributed to the next generation. So your IRA or your 401k, when you reach 70 and a half, and I'm sure most of you have heard that before, you have to start taking out required minimum distributions. If there's a surviving spouse, typically the surviving spouse will roll over that IRA, make it his or her own IRA, and the same rules would apply. At 70 and a half, there's the required distributions. The rules change dramatically when it becomes a beneficiary IRA. So in other words, the IRA is left to a non-spouse. And when I say IRA, I mean 401k or 403b, other retirement type of accounts. When it's left to a non-spouse beneficiary, they are not permitted to wait until 70 and a half. They're required to take minimum distributions beginning by December 31st of the year after death. And the amount that has to come out each year, that required minimum distribution, is based on their age and life expectancy. So there's an IRS chart and it says beneficiary, you're, let's say, 43 years old, your life expectancy is probably somewhere around 40 years, and this is the percentage that would have to come out. If the beneficiary takes advantage of that and just takes that minimum distribution every year, it's called stretching out the IRA, and it's extremely powerful. It can turn about a $200,000 IRA for a 50-year-old taking out minimum distributions, let's say, for the next 30 years into around $700,000 and still be a couple hundred thousand left. That's just for a 50-year-old, and it goes up dramatically if you have a 30-year-old or you're looking at grandchildren where there's a 13-year-old.
Yeah,
the problem is
these stretch rules are very nice if people take advantage of it.
If they don't, and that's where I was just going to say, the problem is the statistic I've heard is 85% of beneficiaries do not take out the distributions. They cash out the IRA within 8 months or 9 months. And, you know, then the whole IRA just gets blown. It becomes a cottage. It becomes a boat or something like that, or pays credit cards or goes to creditor.
And that's after it's taxed at 40%, because if they take it out all in 1 year, chances are it's going to put them into the highest tax bracket.
That's exactly right. And then the other problem that you have is, let's say that the beneficiary loves that concept and wants to stretch it out. It is not creditor protected. So if it's your IRA, it's protected from your creditors. When it becomes an inherited IRA, or sometimes called a beneficiary IRA, the creditor protection is off. So this is where a retirement trust comes in. What the retirement trust does is it guarantees that stretch out of the IRA. And I like to say, when you create that stretch out, you're creating a pension. It guarantees that stretch out, and it also has creditor protection.
So you're not talking about a guaranteed return on the investment. You're just talking about the structure of payments, right?
That's right. We're guaranteeing that the stretch out occurs so that the beneficiary is taking the minimum distributions. And the way that the trust works is the beneficiary of the IRA will be this separate trust. I'm not referring to the revocable trust that many of your clients may have. This is a separate trust, and the trust says that every year the minimum distribution, the required minimum distribution, will be pulled from the IRA and then distributed to the beneficiary. If the beneficiary needs more, they would go to the trustee, and which would be somebody that the client would choose, or it could be there's some professional trustees that they could choose, but it would be an individual trustee, and that trustee would make that distribution. Again, if they need more, they would say to the trustee, I need more, and depending on how the trust is set up, there could be discretionary provisions in there that would allow a trustee to make a distribution over and above the required minimum distribution.
So when you counsel people, are most people enjoying the idea of a retirement trust, or is it only for a certain niche where we have problematic children that are spendthrifts? I mean, what does the traditional case look like?
I will tell you that I would say, I don't have the exact statistics on it, but I would say probably 80% or so of my clients are taking advantage of this. They really like the concept that they're creating a pension for their children. They love that there's creditor protection. You know, if a child gets divorced, now we're dealing with divorce law to protect the assets, as opposed to what does the trust document say. And I make sure that there's language in there that would allow us to protect the assets, protect the IRA in the event of a divorce or other creditor issue.
So if the kid gets divorced, normally something like this could be split 50-50. But if you have the retirement trust, you have a much better chance of keeping the money in the family.
That's exactly right.
Okay. Yeah, that's pretty nice.
And the other thing, too, is it gives protection to the children. You know, one of the things that I've seen happen over the years, when there's a benefit, when a parent dies and now the children are the beneficiaries of the retirement account, it's not necessarily the children that are saying, hey, let's go spend this money. It's the spouse of the children.
Yeah, right. They don't have the emotional connection with the money like a lot of the beneficiaries, the children would.
That's exactly, you know, they didn't see the sacrifice. It's really, it becomes like a lottery winning. You know, I'm sure many of you have seen a situation where somebody won a lottery and that money gets blown so fast and then they run into IRS issues and other problems. This is just a way to really protect that retirement account. So that they're getting, the beneficiaries are getting a check from mom and dad or their grandparents well after the death has occurred.
Mark, in your 25 plus years of practicing law, how long have you been working with retirement trusts?
I've been working with retirement trusts pretty heavily over the last, I would say, 6 years that I've been doing a lot of them. They've been in existence a little longer than that. There was a ruling on the IRS that gave kind of the go-ahead for these, and that's where they become more popular that I thought it made sense. You know, I'll see a lot of times where a revocable trust is listed as the beneficiary. You can run into a lot of problems and lose that ability to get stretch out unless everything is set up perfectly in that document. And the one of the issues you run into is you have some competing interests between the retirement assets and the non-retirement assets. And then you may have language in the revocable trust document that would cause the ability to stretch out the IRA to be lost. And so I recommend to segregate the IRA assets from the non-IRA assets.
Yeah, so a lot of people, you know, let's say husband and wife, maybe two or three kids, you know, think of you and me, right? We both have three kids. We're both married. So I have my IRA, and traditionally you name your spouse as the primary beneficiary so they can take advantage of the spousal acceptance rules. And then as your contingent beneficiary, you know, you could name the kids outright, or you can name your trust, like you were saying, the revocable trust. That's the way I see it 99% of the time. But what you were just explaining was that the revocable trust, it has to be written properly, where it could force all the money out within 5 years and eliminate the need for the ability to stretch, right?
That's correct.
And then the second part is, I have three minor kids, right? So if I name the minors as contingent beneficiaries outright, and of course it would only go to them if my wife and I are both gone. So now, you know, we've named someone in our will, you know, grandma, as the guardian, right, and conservator. So now, you know, she's going to have to be in charge of these IRA assets for the children, right?
That's exactly. So if you have a minor that's a beneficiary of the retirement account, and now death occurs, and that retirement account is payable to a minor, well, a minor cannot control funds. So in your example, grandma would have to go to court, probate court, and establish a conservatorship to be able to control the funds on behalf of your children. That's a bad result.
It's a complete mess.
It's a complete mess and an expensive process. Every year, they're going to have to go back to probate court, file some additional documents, and some of the judges will require that the conservator obtain a bond, a surety bond, which can be a real expensive process, $2,000 to $3,000 a year on top of all the other fees. That's really a bad outcome. A much better way to handle it is right through trust.
Yeah, that makes sense. So this, not to beat a dead horse here, but the retirement trust is not the same revocable living trust that you might recommend as part of a traditional, more common estate plan. It's a separate trust, and it's part of your package deal, right?
Yeah. So it's, the general revocable trust, whether it's a single individual or a married couple, that's kind of the foundational documents, which would consist of the revocable trust, power attorney, patient advocate, a will, and some other ancillary documents. This is kind of, the retirement trust is sort of the next phase in the foundational ladder of estate planning.
Okay.
But I usually do it right at the same time as we're doing the initial documents.
Got it. So you're kind of answering one of the next questions I was going to have, talking about your most common mistakes, right, is not having that whole package. Maybe people think, well, I have a will, right? What else do I need? And as you mentioned, you know, there's the trust, there's the power of attorney, there's the titling of the house, right? So what do you typically see for most people as part of that package? What, did I miss anything right there?
No, yeah, I mean, you know, the will, power of attorney, patient advocates, what I like to call the disability documents, kind of a newer document that we create because there was a change in the law, is something called a funeral representative, where you can appoint who makes funeral arrangements on your behalf. What was happening was families were showing up at a funeral home and, you know, the son says, I want to do it this way, and the daughter says, I want to do it this way, and there, you know, became arguments. And so the legislature put together a statute that says you can appoint who that decision maker is. And so I typically create that for clients also at the same time. You want to make sure you, in addition, that you have a HIPAA release. So let's give you an example. Let's say you're competent, you're in the hospital. Who can call the nurse's station to get in any information? Without a document in place, the hospital will not talk to anyone, will not give any information, because it would be a violation of HIPAA law.
Okay, so we got to have all these documents. It's not okay just to have, you know, to pick and choose. But once you write the documents, right, there's more to it. It's not just signing them and then you're all set. I mean, what do you have to do next?
Well, once a trust is set up, you need to do what we call fund the trust. So I have an account with you, Nick. I need my account to say the Mark Wander Trust as opposed to just Mark Wander. And the difference is if the account is just in my name and I pass away, my wife would have to go to probate court to gain access to that account. If it's titled in the trust, I pass away, my wife as the successor trustee would take over that account the next day and be able to give you direction and have access to the funds without any probate court.
Obviously, there's a better choice there. What about if people just had everything joint, right? So in your example, it was titled in your name rather than the trust, but also it could be joint, right? So we see this a lot. You know, what's the difference between joint and having that trust funded?
Yeah. So let's say my account with you, instead of saying Mark Wander, says Mark and Amy Wander. Amy's my wife. Now we both pass away. We are in probate court. You know, we know for sure we're both going to die at some point. But what happens in the event of a disability? Maybe I pass away first and now my wife lacks capacity. We're back in probate court. Using a trust, we can avoid all of those issues. So we're checking the box to deal with what happens upon death, and we're checking the box what happens in the event of disability. There can also be some tax issues, reasons that we would want to have a trust, but you know, the main thing is just to make sure where the assets go, who controls in the event of death or disability.
So when you say in tax, are you referring to the estate tax exemption?
Yeah, the estate tax. You know, the exemption now is very high, which is it's $11 million and really $22 million for husband and wife. Some of the estate tax reasons where we would create two separate trusts, one trust for the husband, one trust for the wife, for most people are not necessary anymore because of this high estate tax exemption. So a couple things. Number one is, if you are someone that has created documents where not too long ago we had a real exemption of $600,000. If you're someone that created documents and you have two separate trusts, you're a married couple, it probably makes sense to have everything reviewed, and it may make sense to have a joint trust. However, if your client, let's say that this for married people, and let's say the wife is a physician and she's concerned about lawsuits, it may make sense to have two separate trusts for more of the asset protection purposes than the estate tax. So it's the important thing is that you meet with an attorney, and you want to meet with someone that's an estate planning attorney, not someone that does a little of this, a little of that. And you want to make sure that the questions are drawn out and you have a conversation so that the attorney understands really what's going on in your world.
It's crazy that 20 years ago the estate tax exemption was like $650,000 compared to now of $11 million. I mean, think about your term life insurance, right? I mean, those are a dime a dozen, $1 million here, $1 million there. You're immediately over the exemption, and you know estate tax planning would be you know, much more difficult. But now, almost nobody is going to be over 11 million. I mean, let's face it, it's 0.01% of the population, right?
And add to that, for a married couple, it's 22 million.
There you go.
There's something that under the newer law for estate tax, that the first death, if everything goes to the surviving spouse, at the second death, the spouse can use the exemption that the first spouse didn't use, so 11 million, and then they would have their own exemption.
So I think they're trying to put the estate attorneys out of business by making it easy, right?
I hope that's not it. You know, it's actually interesting. I've had family members ask me, you know, is the estate tax rules going to affect you? And number one, it really hasn't. And number two, I don't think it will, because what I've seen over the years is what motivates clients to act is not the tax issues, it's the emotional issues. It's making sure that their children are protected, or their child that maybe has special needs, or they have a beneficiary that has some, you know, maybe substance abuse issues, and they don't want to disinherit them. What are the things that we can do to protect them? Or they have an elderly parent that they want to make sure they provide for in the case something happens. Those are the motivating factors, and I think they always have been, they always will be. It's just, you know, is what else needs to be done after you get those things in place, and that's typically where the estate tax discussion comes in.
Another motivating factor could be you know, a blended family where there's a remarriage and there's a couple kids on each side, right?
100%, you know, so if you have a situation where everything is left to the surviving spouse, and now the first death occurs, everything's left, let's say it's the wife that's the surviving spouse, and she then remarries, it's very possible that everything goes to, and then she dies, everything goes to the second or actually be third husband in this situation, and nothing goes to the children from her spouse. And, you know, I've done a lot of planning over the years where we make sure that spouse is provided for, but also to make sure that the children are provided for. And it's not that difficult, and everyone leaves those conversations feeling good about what they set up.
Mark, another very common thing that we hear a lot about is what to do with the house. You know, a lot of times a married couple own the house in joint title. A lot of times we see attorneys recommending a quitclaim deed or a ladybird deed. I mean, what do you tell people with the house?
Okay, so if you're single and you have a trust, 99% of the time we're going to say let's title it in the trust today. There's some other reasons not to, but for most people we typically say trust. If you're a married couple, that's a different answer. A married couple owning real estate joint together, and you see the deed will say, you know, John Doe and Jane Doe, husband and wife, or something to that effect. That is a certain protection in Michigan called tenants by the entireties. And what that means is if one of them were to be sued, so let's say the husband is sued, that house is still protected. Only a creditor of only the husband and wife would be able to attach the house to satisfy a judgment. What I see lawyers do sometimes is they'll take it out of that ownership and they will put it into the trust, which that breaks that protection immediately when that deed is signed. And then, so that's a bad result. So same accident happens, now the husband's creditor would have access to the house. The problem that you hear, and the reason that lawyers will put it in the trust now is, well, if they both die at the same time or shortly after, then we're going to end up in probate court because the house is owned by two people that have passed away. A better answer is to create something called the ladybird deed, and it's kind of like a deed that creates a beneficiary designation, and this is a revocable life estate, essentially, so it would stay in the husband and wife's name. They could always sell the property, but it would stay in their name for their lifetime. When they both pass away, it then goes into the trust without any probate court. We would just record a death certificate. And that is a much better way to have it. So they have the best of both worlds. They keep the liability protection, but they also avoid probate. You will see some lawyers will create a deed, a quitclaim deed typically, and they put this in the drawer, and they tell their clients to tell their children when they die, you know, go record the deed. I'm not a fan of that at all. There's a few reasons. Number one is when clients come to me for initial meetings and I say, I need to see a copy of your deed, they can't even put their hands on a deed. How are the children 30 years later ever going to find that deed? And the answer is they won't. Number two is there is a question when that deed is signed. So let's say that the husband and wife transfer the property in this deed to their children. Well, that transfer occurred right at the time that quitclaim deed, even though it's not recorded, but once that deed is signed, that's a transfer.
So even though it's just in the drawer in the kitchen?
That's right. So now the son, let's say, gets sued. Does he own the property now that property would be at risk from the son's creditors? And there's some debate both sides, but there's no reason to do it. There's much easier way and more efficient way to do the planning.
Mark, what do you recommend for people once they've, you know, had all their documents drawn up and everything's been executed? How often should these things be reviewed? I mean, is it something that I'm one and done and I can never think about it again? Or what do you recommend?
No. What I tell clients is every 2 years. And one thing I do is I put in my patient advocate document something called a reaffirmation that tells them, and I instruct them at the signing conference to every 2 years re-sign this document to say these are still my wishes. And then I tell them at the same time, when you're signing that document, give me a call and let's just have a review, typically over the phone. And then out of that phone conversation, I may say to them, you know what, you should come in and we should really sit down because there's been enough changes that it makes sense for us to meet.
There could be changes in the family dynamic. Maybe, you know, they've accumulated more assets or, you know, a change in anything could result in a need to make an update.
That's right. You know, you may have some of the beneficiaries that are listed in there maybe passed away or their circumstances change or a trustee has passed away. And as you said, their assets have changed. So, you know, I make sure to send out a letter every 2 years to remind people for review, and we follow up with them. But I think it really makes sense for the client on their end to do the same thing, to get in touch with their estate planning lawyer to make sure that is happening. I tell clients to make it a recurring appointment in their, you know, for those that keep an electronic calendar.
That's a good idea. That way you don't have to think about it.
That's right.
Yeah. Hey, what do you think about people who use, you know, these do-it-yourself programs, like you hear advertising for LegalZoom or prepaid legal, stuff like that, where people think that they're saving a couple bucks? You know, can you make the case against doing that?
Yeah, number one, you know, when you're sitting at the computer filling it out, the computer doesn't know the questions to ask you, and some of the things that come out in a meeting, there's no way that's ever going to be in those documents. The biggest problem you run into with those documents is they may look nice, but you don't know what you don't know. And you know, a lot of the things that I put in my documents dealing with retirement accounts or some other contingencies, those are not in those documents. You know, I ran into a situation, a client came to me and said, you know, I've created these from LegalZoom, and LegalZoom or that other, there's another one, I can't think of the name of it. And I look at the document and I said, when did you live in California? And they said, never. And I said, well, this is loaded with all sorts of law related to California, and California has completely different laws related than we do in Michigan. It's a community property state. There's all sorts of problems. But the document looked good and they saved some money on attorney fees.
So you just mentioned different states. I mean, what if, you know, I lived in Ohio for a number of years and now I'm in Michigan, or maybe I've moved out of state. You know, what does that change? How does that change dynamics?
Yeah, you want to have those documents reviewed by a Michigan lawyer. You know, if you're lived in another state and now you're living here, or if I have a client that moves to another state, I always help them find a lawyer in the state that they're moving to. I have, through an association I'm involved with, I have very competent estate planning lawyers all over the country, you know, that are in the same association. You want to have the documents reviewed. Some states have different laws related to estate tax. There's a state inheritance tax where Michigan does not have that. That could affect the document. So you definitely want to have those out-of-state documents reviewed. And many times we will replace them with Michigan documents.
Makes sense. Yeah, it makes sense on a lot of these topics. So before I let you go, Mark, I'm going to nail you down for a prediction. Two predictions, okay?
Okay.
I want to know who's going to win the Michigan-Michigan State football game this fall. And I want to know who's going to win the Big Ten in football.
Listen, I bleed green and white, and that's the only way I'm going. Michigan State is the answer to both of those.
Oh, to
it's
both.
It's going to be a good turnaround year for Michigan State in terms of getting some positive publicity. We've had a rough run the last few months, and I think football is going to put a smile on a lot of Spartans this year.
Yeah, it has been a rough period of time here. We won't go into that. But I do respect the bold opinion of Michigan State winning the Big Ten. That's not going to be easy.
I'm really excited about our quarterback. Lewerke's had a great year last year, and he's going to be even better this year. And the offensive line's going to be real strong. I think our secondary is going to be one of the best in the country. So I'm all positive on Michigan State this year.
Great. Well, hey, Mark, thanks for coming on the show. I appreciate it.
Thanks a lot. Take care.
That was some great stuff from Mark Wander, estate planning attorney. You can learn more about Mark at mwanderlaw.com. But let's think about this for a second, this retirement trust concept. If I pass away and my kids are inheriting my IRA, I can basically force them to stretch out the money over their lifetime rather than allowing them to just cash it out and do something stupid with it. I mean, you know, you like to think that your kids would make the smart decision, but believe me, you know, Mark stated the 85% likelihood that people are just going to cash it out. I think that's probably fairly consistent with what I see from my own practice here at Peak. The beneficiaries cash the money out. It's very foolish. So if you can force them to stretch it out, definitely an interesting option. So once again, thanks to Mark for coming on. You can reach him at mwanderlaw.com or zeroprobate.com. And if you have over $500,000 and you're thinking about how your money relates to your estate plan, please give us a call or check us out at peakwm.com. You can apply for an appointment on peakwm.com. And if you have not downloaded the Podbean app for your iPhone or Android, that's the best place to listen. Thanks. Talk to you later.
You've been listening to the Peak Financial Minute with Nick Hopwood. You can subscribe to this podcast through iTunes and the Android Marketplace or by visiting www.peakwm.com. Peak Wealth Management is your premier wealth management partner. Plan, protect, peak. Securities offered through Regulus Advisors, LLC. Member FINRA SIPC. Investment advisory services offered through Peak Wealth Management, LLC, a state of Michigan registered investment advisor. Peak Wealth Management, LLC is independent of Regulus Advisors.